This film wasn't made to entertain, but to question. If you like it, please love it hard. If you hate it with vigor. That's basically life, light and darkness.
Hello there, people. This is another mid-month episode. Now, there hasn't been one for a while. I've not got an excuse, so I'm just going to move on. When I compile this podcast month after month, I get used to these patterns and these tropes where before I just didn't see them. I guess if you watch two or three movies a day, they're just going to blend together somewhat. So when I'm dealing with the early 80s, there's always some slashers, and they come, of course, in all shapes and sizes. In the 70s, there is a ton of exploitation movies and giallos. In the 90s, you've got the rise of teen horror, that phenomenon, etc., etc. I could go on. But every now and again, something stands out. And this month, just in case you do not already know about this, I watched a movie that really stood out from the pack. It was a low-budget masterwork. In fact, friend of the podcast, Jed Shepherd, who he had on talking about Night of the Comet, his review of this on Letterboxd says the following. I saw this at Glasgow Film Festival 2020 with the director's Q&A. He made this beautiful film for 20K. None of us have an excuse anymore. It is a slow burn affair that I really didn't get on my first viewing. I watched it on Shudder initially, but I knew there was something that I loved about it, and I don't normally do this. I sort of felt about this one the same that I felt about that folky charm and that bleak as hell worldview that I saw in Hagazusa. So what I did, I purchased it. I purchased one of the special editions of the film from the Fractured Visions label, and that was a very pleasant surprise on delivery day when it was just such a beautiful package. So, as this doesn't happen so often, I thought, as I've said, we should just put out this special episode for it. And here it is. Today, we are going to be completely spoiler-free because, as I say, I still think this is really underseen. But also, somehow, we're still getting quite in-depth about how this was made and why this was made. And also, it was made in Colombia. This is called Luz, the flower of evil.
Tommy, señor, me dices de alimento. Haz que estas tierras crezcan. La vida de nuestro señor, que somos como ciertos sirvientes y vasallos. Alejando de todo el mal y nuestras cosas del amor. Haz estas tierras y esta familia. Haz esta familia de Jesús. Guíanos a su reino. Nosotros somos tus enviados, y tu luz, tu voz en la tierra.
Here's that Letterboxd synopsis. Good and evil are the same being. Far into the mountains, in a community led by a preacher named El Señor, a new child who is supposed to be the new Messiah is brought, and with him, destruction and redemption. Now, after watching this again and forming some opinions of my own on what this whole thing means, I searched around looking at who had created this world that these strange characters inhabit, and I discovered that Luz was produced, directed, written, and edited by a fellow named Juan Diego Escobar Alzate. Now, of course, I reached out to him and I asked for a chat, and Juan was game, which leads us to this. It is spoiler-free, it's 25 minutes, it's a discussion about his movie, about Colombia, and about genre film in general. I'll see you on the other side, we can talk all about the soundtrack after this. Juan, welcome to the podcast.
No, it is a pleasure to be here with you. I really appreciate the invitation, and I love to share all the things that I know or my experience with genre fans, and of course, with genre geeks and freaks such as me.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's the audience that I like to appeal to. So, yeah, fantastic. And thank you so much for agreeing to do it. I watched your film, only caught it for the very first time last month. And the first thing that hit me was, who the hell is this person that's directed this? Because it doesn't look like a first-time director. So basically, what I want to get through in this interview, I've already talked a bit about what I thought of the film and some bits and bobs about around it, but I would love to find out a bit more of your life and how you've come to make this thing. So okay. I just want to kick off with, what's your earliest experiences of horror? As a child, what was the thing that made you think, oh, you know, this is something that I'm really enjoying, I really am addicted to?
Cool. Yeah. It's a very interesting question. I mean, ever since I come from Colombia, I mean, I'm Colombian born. Of course, here in Colombia, it's like the third world. I mean, South America, it's also very religious territory. And of course, Colombia, and especially the town that I live in, that it's a very small town, in the coffee region of Colombia, that is called Manizales. It's full of Catholicism and all of this. So, for example, for me, that I'm a filmmaker and a genre filmmaker, if I'm a freak in here, I'm more of a freak. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And basically, I can recall. The earliest memories that I can recall, of course, are the ones that make me a filmmaker, or that really made me the person that I am today. I remember that since I was a child, like I would say like 6, 8 years old, my father, all the Sundays, they air on TV, basically several Westerns on television. So my father, to keep me entertained, just put me to watch these Westerns. And I fell in love with those Westerns, and I wanted all the Sundays to come. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
They started to show several spaghetti Westerns. And as I grew up and internet started to evolve, and I started to seek these films that I watched as a child. And basically, I kept track of these directors of spaghetti Westerns. And as spaghetti Westerns ended, most of these directors, Lucio Fulci, Sergio Martino, Dario Argento, they went to direct giallo films. And that's how I passed the bridge between spaghetti Westerns to horror films. And that's when I fell in love with horror, basically, due to this director. So that's the thing that I can recall.
That's great. I mean, I know a little bit about the cinema system in Colombia. Well, I think I know a bit, so maybe you'll put me right. As far as I'm aware, because of the religious aspects of like horror films every now and again, they won't get shown. And in the cinemas, there is things more like, again, I'm not 100% sure, but like extended TV films and things like that. Is that the case?
Yeah, I would say that here we don't have like a very big studio system, or like the films that often get into billboards. I mean, into big cinemas or big theaters or blockbusters, such as, they tend to be like, I would say like extension of television. It's basically the same, pure entertainment. So a film such as Luz would never get into a big main venue, such as those one that, of course, like here, people in Colombia, they're not, we need really to educate the public. Because basically all that people consume, and because it's a low income country like the third world, people right. are accustomed, of course, to watch just television, because they don't have money to go to the movies or to pay for Netflix, or many people doesn't even have a credit card or something such as. So maybe tell a story such as Luz or something like this, that of course it's like heavy, it's a heavy film. Full of things of metaphors. And I won't say it's an intellectual film, but it's not an easy film to follow. So, for example, for people here, it would be impossible to understand it. So it really is not on the mainstream here or the studio system. So, yeah, films here are basically extension of television.
I love how it began for you with giallos. That's really interesting. You can definitely see the influence of Westerns in your movie, but giallos, maybe not so much. That's really interesting. I mean, what do you yourself pull out of horror? How's it make you feel? What's the crux that made you want to get into this game?
Well, definitely, I consider myself as a genre filmmaker. As I told you, since my first love was genre films, was horror, was Western, was this kind of fantasy films. So I wanted also like to make genre films because I consider that it's an excuse also and a very interesting way to portray the horrors of mankind or basically to criticize something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I always find like movies, like the purpose of movies doesn't have to be just pure entertainment, but to question. And I find that horror films, often they're just pure entertainment. And I wanted like exactly to put my own and personal poetic voice and tone into this. As I say, I consider that films, like I consider film to be the greatest of all artworks or art forms. And I find that the greatest art form of them all or the outcome is to heal or help heal. So that's basically why Luz, it's very ethereal, very poetic, very metaphysical in some sort of way, very, I don't know how to say it, like floating, like very acid, kind of.
Yeah, well, you definitely feel that watching your movie. There is a definite movement towards this, a real split in recent years where certain genre films are going in that direction that you've taken, Luz. But also there is a resurgence of that old school slash and bash type thing as well. And it sort of seems to be separating, whereas some fans are not fans of one side of things and then they're not fans of the other. So, yeah, it's interesting that you've gone this way about it, especially coming from where you have done. I mean, with this film, I know a little bit about the making of it because I've watched the Blu-ray, but I need to ask, you took on the roles of the writer, of the producer, director, and the editor. Now, this is a huge amount of work, and I take it this was years in the making.
Yeah, I mean, it was 5 to 6 years in the making, especially, of course, because we needed to raise money to a film that isn't commercially driven. So that's harder, of course. It was a first film, my first feature film, so it's even harder to finance something such as. And of course, financing also a genre films in Latin America is also harder and harder, of course, especially here in Colombia. That's basically horror is not something very common. I mean, you can see one horror per year for in the billboards here in Colombia. I mean, wow. Colombian film. So it's very hard. So yeah, it took me a while. And of course, I started filmmaking in the United States. And I knew, for example, several things such as color correction, several things, of course, such as VFX. So basically what I did to keep the budget low was, of course, to make like a rough cut and pass it to the VFX guy. I want to make the stars look like something like this. And then because I had a rough draft, it was lower the budget to pay him. So basically, but it was very hard, of course, because the film, of course, it's very complex, as you can see. And of course, shooting in the wilderness, of course, it's very hard, especially yes. Here because in Colombia, we don't have seasons. So any day can rain, or any day can be sunny. I mean, it's not a predictable weather, such as where in other countries that you have seasons. So, and this film was shot only in 18 days. So you can imagine.
Now, I need to ask you about the editing process here, because this is where a film such as yours will either fall or succeed. And I imagine the pressure was really on at this point for you. Like, how do you take everything that you've filmed and get that edited correctly? Was you ever in doubt that you had the right process going on?
What I liked very much about making this film is that I told you it wasn't commercially driven, meaning that the people that I mean, the founders of the film or the investors to the film, they didn't expect nothing at all. And especially for me, that was the point as well. I mean, I didn't knew, for example, that the film would be a successful film in film festivals, or that it would sell worldwide. Or I didn't have that idea since I shot it. Because I never thought about income. I never thought about something. I only thought about playing and about making a film that serves all the crew and cast as an experience to help open doors so we can shoot the second film with a higher budget. So for me, I never felt the weight on my shoulders or anything such as. So it was a very wonderful experience, because nobody was telling me, there was not a producer telling me, oh no, I don't like this, this isn't commercial, or this won't sell. So I just did what I liked, and many people hate it and many people love it. And for me, that's totally okay.
I love that. So absolutely no consideration of, is this going to be successful if I do it this way? I'm just going to follow my artistic vision and we'll see what happens.
That's it. And basically that's what is loose. I mean, loose in Spanish, it's light. I mean, it's like the definition is light. And basically the film talks about duality, as you may see, dark, light, or love, hate, or God and the devil. And for me, that's exactly how is art, like yin and yangs, meaning that it's full of hate or full of love. And for me, this film is exactly that. People, it's a film that whether you will love it or whether you will hate it, there's no middle ground. And for me, I'm totally fine with that. I mean, I have stumbled with people that love it very, very much and people that hate it very much. So I wrote on the Blu-ray that you have there, I mean, in the booklet, I don't know if you check it out, it's handwritten on the end, but I will read it to you. It says, thank you for buying this gorgeous collector's edition of Luz. This film wasn't made to entertain, but to question. If you like it, please love it hard. If you hate it with vigor. That's basically life, light and darkness. Nothing is perfect. Everything are yings and yangs. With too much love from me, Phil, and my mother.
That's magic. Love that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a film that basically opened me doors that I've never imagined, really. I've never imagined that it would play on Sitges, that it would get distribution on by Shutter or something like this. I mean, for me, it wasn't something that was in my mind.
Well, before we get there, I just want to mention here the color palette and the cinematography. So I'm a real big fan of this film called Hagazusa.
I love fucking Hagazusa, man.
Okay. I'm glad you've seen it.
It's one of my favorite films of lately.
It's very similar in tone to yours, not story, but in tone. And I was questioning, am I thinking of your film or am I thinking of Hagazusa when I think of these things? And the thing that always separates it for me is that color palette that you've chosen. It's so distinctive. Again, I understand that you've had this vision and you're going to stick with it. But what inspired such a unique color palette to this film? Because you know when you've seen it, there's no mistaking this.
Cool. Yeah. Basically, I wanted to portray the beauty of nature. It's a film that talks about nature, especially like and how basically men through religion and manhood corrupts everything. So, for example, for me, as you can see, this is an enormous land full of enormous and gorgeous vistas. And what I wanted exactly to make is that something that feels like the Eden, like something idyllic, just like these girls are like kind of nymphs. So I've always been in love with painting as well. So several paintings of Rembrandt or by John William Waterhouse, like Hylas and the Nymphs, like served me for inspiration. And also my background mostly is that I direct video clips for several artists that are very popular.
I like pop videos.
I have done pop, rock, heavy metal. I mean everything basically. Okay. But for several bands such as Char Leon, Manuel Medrano, Matt Simmons, Escape the Fate. I mean, for some popular bands around the world. And basically, my background as it's in video clips, as you know, video clips are very aesthetic and very plastic. So that's what I wanted to make in this film, something that feels very, very, very beautiful and Edenic, and something that you can watch and see and say, oh man, how the fuck this guy could make this film with $20,000? I wanted to like people to get also that experience, because for me, basically, this was the my love letter to cinema and also the letter of presentation to the film world or the film industry.
There is a moment in the film where you're a voyeur and you're looking at the sisters washing themselves in the lake, and it's such a beautiful shot. It's so gorgeous. And
yeah,
I feel like at that moment filming that, you must have been like, this is the one. This is, I've got it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, when we were scouting, we all fell in love with that spot. I mean, with that waterfall, it's incredibly enormous. We fell in love with that, with the scouting, and really, I couldn't wait to shoot this film because we scouted and then we shot it a year after. But I wanted to shoot right in because it's such a beautiful setting and landscapes really here in my hometown, and those were very, very wild. I mean, they are very they are not corrupted by houses or something like that. It's pure virgin. I mean,
it's stunning. So this leads us to the moment where the film is wrapped, and then now you've got to flog it, you've got to sell this thing. So you, I can see, have done several film festivals. How was that? How did that feel that you're now in a different position, I take it, than you've been before, where you actually have to like introduce this film to people? How was that for you?
Well, for me, always my dream, such as I'm into genre films since I'm a child, for me, my dream wasn't the Oscars or anything like that, was playing at Sitges. For me, that was my overall dream of all time. And for me, when we submitted the film at the beginning and they took the film into the main competition, for me was something that I never in my life would dream of. For me, it was my wildest dream, of course. And it made me so happy because after playing in a festival, that's basically where all the doors get open to other film festivals or invitations or talks or distribution or sales agencies or something such as. So for me, playing in such a special and beautiful festival really opened me many doors for this film and for the films to come as well.
Well, you've mentioned you can find this on Shudder. This box set is gorgeous, and that's available now to us in the West. Is this something that is a bit of a dream come true for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's totally a dream come true. And as I say, even more of a dream, because for me, I wanted to make just a film that basically could get some views in Colombia, but I've never really imagined that my first feature could travel the world and get into many festivals and won awards and got distribution and got this sort of treatment that Fractured Visions gave it on that beautiful box set of the Blu-ray that you got, because it's so freaking gorgeous. So for me, it's been, of course, more than a dream come true, because also I am a Blu-ray and DVD collector. So for me, having this on physical media is something that that even in my wildest of dreams, I couldn't imagine. So it's been a cool journey and a long ride, but it's been so significant and full of upside downs, of course, as well.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me. I've got one final question, but this is,
sure,
I hope, going to be quite a long-winded answer, because I can't wait to hear. What's next? What have you got cooking?
Okay, of course, many people ask that. Many people ask that. However, for example, as I told you, I made Luz to help me open doors. Those doors got open through an Argentinian co-production it's my next project, that it's called Searching for the Black Rainbow, that it's basically also a folk horror film set in the Amazon, with aborigines, with all these kind of things. However, we're still in the process of because we have a big, because Luz costed $20,000, sure, and this one cost $1,700,000. So you can imagine. So, but we still got many budget in place, but we still have left to finance like $200,000, but we will get there. So it's not a film that we will shut it next year, maybe on 2023, but we look forward to that one. And of course, because the pandemic struck, of course, it's becoming harder and harder. So I have another project in development that is a smaller budget. It's like 80K, that's called Deliver Us From Hell. It's also a horror film, but it's about pedophilia. It criticized pedophilia very much. And we look forward to shooting this at the end of next year. So those are my two projects.
Wow. Okay. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Like, yeah, that's the thing. It's so frustrating sometimes when you get auteur directors that have achieved their vision and then that's it and they go away. So that's really good to hear that you're sticking with it. Love that.
No, yeah, for me, I mean, I want to keep doing films as long as producers believe in my vision, I will keep making them. And if producers don't believe in my vision, then I would have to go back to crowdfunding, because I'm not stopping.
Brilliant. Well, I think we can stop there. So Juan, thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for this time and for the invitation. And if people are seeing this, I invite you all to check Luz, to rate it if you can, if you have Letterboxd or if you have IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes, rate it, because for us, it's very important to know what the viewers think, especially if you hate it, write it. If you love it, write it as well.
if I'd only known this. So I've got the soundtrack, it comes with the Blu-ray special edition, but I don't have a CD player to play it on except for in the car, which is not the most ideal place to listen to any music. And for some reason, I just didn't think of looking on Spotify, but there it is, Brian Heater. And it's spelt as in, I'm cold, I'm going to put on the heater. He is the composer. Now, this is crazy to think that right now on Spotify, it's telling me that Brian Heater has only 12 monthly plays. That must have been just me. I've listened to it way more than that. It's insane. This score is a wonderful, wonderful accompaniment to the film, but for the most part, it works really well on its own as well. It is thoughtfully placed and ethereal throughout its length. Mostly listening to this as I have done during the past couple of days on dog walks, it also makes me feel really hopeful. A lot of the time, Heater employs variations on my favourite chord progressions. Now, so you know exactly the ones I'm thinking of, I'm going to play you this. I think this is the most famous place that they've been used. It was by the Police, and they use them on the verses of Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic. So yeah, even when this sounds bleak, because these chords keep getting repeated, no matter how slow, no matter how oddly, even when it is bleak as hell, there's just hope. And yet, if the next track is a major chord one and it's bright sounding, then there is this undercurrent of bleak just around the corner. And I think it's that light and dark again. The ambience is often reminiscent of 80s era Brian Eno, if that floats your boat, so you can think of that. Things do get changed up though. There is two tracks. One is called Jesus Is Saved and the other is called Lullaby, and they are really important to this score. They have this vocal cadence, much like that used in Rosemary's Baby, over this chilling piano motif, which sounds oddly similar to that of that TV show Succession. Overall, I would say I like it. I just don't know how well this goes when I'm listening to it separated from the film. Regardless, give it a shot and just up those Spotify numbers for goodness sake. Where can you watch this? As myself and Juan have already mentioned, Shudder is currently hosting this if you want to watch it for free, or there is this gorgeous Blu-ray on Fractured Visions. And that's your lot. Hope you enjoyed this one-off special. Hope it did a good job of spreading the love with this film. As Juan says, it is not going to be for everybody, but however it makes you feel, fill that with passion. And also, feel free to contact the podcast on ayearinhorror@gmail.com. You can follow me at Waller Not Weller on Letterboxd. That is Waller Not Weller on Letterboxd and Instagram. Or you can hit me up on @NotWellerPod on Twitter. And yes, as you've heard, I have got a cold. Thanks for putting up with me. So until the 1st of December, when we return with a big hitter episode exploring 1982, this has been A Year in Horror.